Thank you, Melanie. Instead of allowing the panelists to respond to your questions, I'm going to take further questions or comments from the audience. Philip Monk.
Well, thank you very much for that enlightening and very entertaining presentation. I have a comment leading into a question, and I think it somewhat restates an unanswered question from Joanne Lambert yesterday, but I want to open that from a different angle. During the 1980s, few writers, art and otherwise, and artists began to pay attention to the museum as a discourse. And among the first that paid attention to that were museums themselves. And they somewhat reaped the windfall and profits of the critique without really fulfilling it or sustaining it. But however, they, I suppose in their self-congratulatory arrogance, began to assume themselves as the center of attention. And I think even though, given the way this conference is structured and given what people have said yesterday, that we really never can get outside of the discourse of the museum. I, from my position outside the museum, I feel a bit uncomfortable in thinking of the museum as being a normative discourse. I think we have to pay attention to, on the one hand, the museum as discourse, and on the other hand, the museum as an actual practice. And to restate what I think Joanne was saying yesterday, we have to look at what the interests of the museum are in engaging in these sorts of activities. And so to my to my question specifically, partly referring to Kitty's exhibition, and then asking the panel as a whole. I saw the browser Bankside in London, which I thought was a very interesting exhibition. And I was very curious, and you in fact stated that the Tate saw this somewhat as a form of PR. And I also see this as a very subtle form of advertising by the institution. Your exhibition and the other exhibitions that they did around the same time. And yet it seems that the institution didn't really sustain this practice once they opened, and they became very much of a conventional museum in what they did inside and didn't ever go back outside the museum once that public relations function was fulfilled when they weren't open yet. And so I guess my question to the panel as a whole is, what, and it's very interesting, and I'm anticipating what is going to be said in the second half by the other panelists, is that these very interesting interventions are taking place outside of the larger institutions, or they're being sponsored by smaller institutions that don't really look at themselves as these aggrandizing museum complexes. So my question is, from your point of view as practitioners of this, why is it so difficult for the museum to sustain this somewhat as a perpetual revolution within the institution?
Thank you, Philip. Kitty, did you get that? Do you want to respond?
Fine, yeah. I guess in some ways, Philip, I sort of say I'm in a funny position with regards to your question, because in some ways I think the Tate did do something, and it is a major museum. So it was both kind of, that particular project was both inside and outside the museum. But I was thinking a little bit about this morning, and I was thinking about how the two different organizations function. This is the Artropolis Board and then the Tate Museum. And I think the Artropolis Board, they were the kind of research and development phase. And that's where we were kind of allowed to develop the prototype. And in a sense, because at that particular time, too, my own identity was a little bit more complex. I was working part-time at the Vancouver Art Gallery. I was also working part-time at the Orr Gallery, and I was also something called an independent curator. So to say exactly what I was probably one half institutional person, one half not, three quarters, I don't know. So there's that kind of complexity with my own identity at the time. And then, I think they allowed for research and development. And because we, in a sense, when Andrew and I met and discussed things, we could sit and talk. We weren't, we were never thinking, no, we can't do that, yes, we can't do that, we have to check with so-and-so if we can do that. We were always just kind of imagining what was possible and always trying to work within an ideal scenario. I think then essentially the board allowed us to realize almost a prototype. And then once the prototype was in place, it was something that then could go from one local situation to another local situation quite easily. Why today museums? Your kind of question was, I guess, more about why this isn't happening in museums. I think it probably is happening in museums quite a bit. It's just that we don't necessarily recognize it or see evidence of it all the time. And if you let me think for a little bit, there are exhibitions that will come to the surface that are doing things like this, and I'll come back to them. I think it is happening.
Do you want to say something briefly, Jennifer? And then there is a question, Vera over here, Ruth here, okay. And anybody else put their hand up.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, question of museums as discourse. I think you have to ask who's speaking, who's communicating as in terms of the exhibition rhetoric. And I think that in each of the projects demanded, and we couldn't go into this, you know, in any extent here, extraordinary collaborations with the institution. And I think we were able to do what we did simply because they were temporary situations. You know, they really demanded a lot of the institutions usually. And were terribly expensive, so they had to be short term. So one of the reasons why, you know, has to do with economics, but also the provisionality of the events themselves, I think, made them what they were.
Thanks. Vera.
I really enjoyed the presentations. I hadn't been able to see any of those exhibitions, so it was good to be introduced to them in this way, and I enjoyed Melanie's response. The sentence, however, that leapt out at me most was one of Kitty's, when she said, I began to think of artists as complex individuals. Well, actually, you said we began to think of artists as complex individuals. And I wondered, Kitty, if you would draw the parallels and differences between Browser and Spring's work, The Final Sleep.
Talk to differences between Spring's work and Browser?
Between Browser as the kind of packaging approach that you took and Spring's work in the way that she... The sentence that Spring posted on the wall, you can correct me if I'm... wrong, was we are all equal in repose. And that haunted me while you were showing that work.
Just to repeat the question, Kitty hears in one ear and not the other. What is the relationship between Browser and Spring Hurlburt's work, the notions of repose, the archive, obviously some of those questions Vera is asking.
Okay, I think they're two very, very different approaches. Spring was working in an institution, in a museum that had a huge collection, and she was going in a way that I think you could compare to somebody like Fred Wilson or Joseph Kossuth, using a collection that already exists and then making displays based on a collection that's already there. Of course, she had to negotiate, as she talked about this yesterday, with all the different departments. I mean, to me, it seems completely normal what she had to go through. Museums are big institutions, and many people have kind of proprietary concerns about the collections, etc. So I'm not surprised at all by what she had to go through. Browser, in a sense, was building a collection from a group of artists who came in and contributed materials. The actual display of Browser was changing all the time in the sense that the display that you saw in the theater of the exhibition per se changed because depending on who was taking out what material and looking at what, we made temporary displays on the table. So you could have a display that would be up for 5 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour, a week, whatever. They were constantly changing. We did, the most flippant display we did was all the Bryans in Browser. So just brought out all the people named Brian, put their work on a table. But we also did more considerate and more thoughtful displays. I just think they're two very different approaches.
Thank you. We'll take two more questions before the break. There'll be time for further questions after the second round. There's Ruth up at the top, and then there was a question down here. Did I read it? It was Ruth? Please get a mic, and this will be Ruth Phillips speaking.
Thank you. It's Ruth Phillips, and I actually would like to go back initially to Philip Monk's question, and if I might, ask him the exact same question about the intervention he commissioned Robert Gould to do at the Art Gallery of Ontario, which Robert talked about yesterday, Anishinaabe Walker Court. This isn't a hostile question, it's a genuine question. I've always wondered, since that was taken down, why it was taken down. That we have in the Art Gallery of Ontario work by a German artist which memorializes living Indigenous peoples of Ontario. We had an Ontario artist who made an intervention which corrected a falsity that is inscribed in the Art Gallery of Ontario. So I'm very curious as to what the politics of the institution were at the time, and perhaps even what they might be now, which prevented what seemed to me an absolutely appropriate intervention from becoming permanent in that institution.
I think we've got the answer both with Philip, and if he fails to answer, and I think he probably would be able to, then Matthew Teitelbaum is here, who was chief curator at the time.
I'm not going to answer that question, really. That's ancient history for me, other than to say that I understand completely what Robert was saying yesterday about getting out of institutions, they make you sick. And I left the institution soon after that. So it's a history for me that I don't want to recover, so I don't really feel like answering.
Matthew, do you want to make an addendum to that? It seems a turning point in the discussion.
I'm not sure I can make a useful response. I wasn't the chief curator at the time.
Oh, he wasn't chief curator at the time. Forgive me, Matthew.
I wasn't the chief curator at the time. I love institutions. We have Robert's work up at the moment. We acquired the studies for the work, and truthfully, I don't know the history either, but I suppose I should before tomorrow morning.
Okay. To be continued.
Just, I am remembering something. I should add that there was a director there who wanted to paint out the Baumgarten work.
Could you identify yourself? Last
sure,
question.
My name is Margaret Dikaritsky. There is a difference between OpenStack library and archives, and I used to work for archives for 4 years, so I know quite a bit about the archives. In the archives, the reader cannot go to stacks and browse the material content of the shelf, so his capacity is very, very limited, and he or she is left with a catalog, which can be computerized, which can be card catalog, but in any case, he or she is left with a catalog. And the choice made is based solely on the description. Don't you think that by asking your viewer to come to the site and make a choice before seeing things, don't you think that you limit your viewers' activity, and you actually delay?
Could you just repeat that? Neither Kitty nor I. That she is letting the viewers. Limiting the viewers.
You're limiting the viewer, and he or she should make sure it's before seeing actual things. So the seeing is delayed, and you create certain exclusions. In case the viewer does not like what he or she sees first in the first box, they should go to the computer and start it all over. And how many boxes are we going to browse at the end? So I don't want to sound retrograde, but it seems to me that you are creating certain exclusions when you are packaging things. And it's the same difference as between OpenStack library and the archives. That's my question.
Thank you very much. I had a bit of trouble hearing that, too. Did you catch any of that, Kitty? Did Jennifer, Jim, Melanie, can you?
It's probably my accent, too.
No, it's, I think it's the, we sort of are deadened here a little bit.
Okay, but I can read it through if you want.
No, but it was to do with the difference between an actual archive and this particular event that Browser was. Am I?
Between an OpenStack library and an archive.
Yes, so.
Pardon?
OpenStack gallery and the archives, exactly.
Okay, so does it need a response? Do we need, or has everybody got? Vera, would you help me here? Jim's going to respond.
There are closed DAX libraries, too. The National Gallery, for instance, is a library in which you normally cannot roam through the stacks. So.
Okay, I have a.
But it's a library as well. So. Mm-hmm.
My understanding of the question, and you can correct me, is first drawing the distinction between an OpenStack resource and an archive and modes of access. And the question had to do with the nature of exclusion being resituated, so that having only the catalog as a way of, as a basis for making a choice, if I understand you correctly, limits your experience of the exhibition. And I think the implication of what you were saying was after one or two bad choices, you're going to give up. Right?
Okay.
That was the comment.
Did you get that, Kitty? Unlike after one or two bad choices in the Browser show, a viewer, somebody who presents themselves to Browser to look at things might easily give up.
Could happen in any art exhibition, couldn't it?
So there is an the issue was that this is a form of exclusion.
So that it is exclusion. A kind of form of exclusion. So yes?
It could happen in any art exhibition. I mean, one could go into an art exhibition, look at one or two bad works, and decide to leave. I think it's really up to the individual spectator. One of the things we really wanted to do was give the spectator the opportunity to browse at their own leisure. And let's say they did make one or two bad choices. They could still wander around and look at what other people were looking at. There were some videos in the collection, people watching videos. So often people would join other people watching videos or, looking at other projects. So, sure, what can I say to you? Sure, but maybe not.
Jennifer, Jim, do you want to... You have a catalog.
Yeah, there's a catalog, a CD. Everything was available on the CD. You could also... that's the catalog.
Okay. I'm going to ask Jim and Jennifer. We're going to close in a moment. I want Jim and Jennifer, if you want to say anything further about this, because your work actually engages some of these issues, too.
Yeah, our projects have similar difficulties in that they're complex, they're large, they're time demanding, and they're also experiments in curatorial practice. So one has to accept a certain amount of risk in terms of conducting these experiments. On the other side, the projects that we do kind of dispense with a linear exhibitionary script. And so in positing a kind of rhizomatic or, kind of multiple locality of an exhibition, one has to admit or keep in mind that no experience is going to be the same. There's no unilateral, singular kind of total experience that every viewer will share. So that's precisely the type of work we're doing. There's a political statement being made in that. There's a kind of agency given over to the viewer in which to negotiate their own experience, and that's just the nature of these projects. I mean, that's the after the modernism that we're trying to experiment and explore.
Thank you. Matthew, you're cut off. We're going to have a 15-minute... Oh, everybody's saying let him speak. All right. Do you really have something to say? Fine, you've got to talk about my moderation.
I'm dissatisfied that you haven't had the panel address Melanie's question about... And it links in part to what Philip said about...
I hear the question. Matthew has said, and he's got applause, so we have to address it, that he's dissatisfied that the panel hasn't had the opportunity to address Melanie's question about audience. Would you do so?
Sure. We're perfect. We're very pleased to be able to do that. I heard two questions that resonated with me. One was the question of the curator also adopting an educator's perspective. There we go. Okay. So two parts to her response that I think Jennifer and I would like to respond to. One is that curators should also incorporate an educator's perspective and orientation into their projects, and as well to also to address notions of community. Especially since Jennifer and I raised that in our kind of opening paragraph. In regards to the first, as we are educators, we teach in universities, education and pedagogy is very central to our practice, and in most of our projects to varying degrees, there is a great attention to the educational component, but it may not be the educational component in a traditional sense of interpreting, animating, explaining the work to individuals. In regards to vital signs, we organized a huge international conference. We would understand that to be a kind of educational component. In terms of museopathy, which was a an off-site exhibition that included non-art museums, we took it upon ourselves, along with the Agnes Evington Art Center, to train the staff at each of these institutions to help them in understanding the work, being able to present and converse about it. So there was a great attempt to work with the institutions and the individuals who were interfacing with the public on an intimate and daily level.
And just on a more experimental basis, just to say really quickly, in the servant problem, I think the role of the guard was really, really interesting because it was this sort of setup, like people were coming to the museum and they expected to go into the house as normal. And there's this security museum guard getting very uppity and asking them to look in their purses and asking them personal questions. And some people at first thought he was a real guard and gave him that authority. And then finally everyone had this epiphanal moment where they realized, like candid camera, that, you know, there was this sort of situational deconstruction of this ideology. So that's the surprising kind of element you can put into that becomes revelatory or exhibition centered, I suppose, in some way.
Yeah, I'm just going to answer in a very practical manner with just as a kind of case study answer. With Browser, we had many people engaged in working in the exhibition to facilitate viewers. I don't necessarily think we call them educators, but we kind of called them pseudo-archivists or scripted archivists. And you were greeted once you came into the exhibition right away by somebody who asked to take your ID card, like you would be in any archive, and you were told the rules of the archive, so you knew what kind of place you were coming into. Then you were invited to either search the database or the binders, or if you didn't want to do that, you could also talk to one of the archivists. They had sort of favorite boxes, all of them, and they would suggest, well, why don't you look at number 10 and number 36 or number 42? There were a lot of people working in this exhibition to facilitate your experience, more so than you would see in the National Gallery, per se, when you walk in to look at contemporary art. It's a very different kind of experience for the viewer or the spectator, participant, researcher.
Thank you. We really must take a break now to let the second half speak. 15 minutes sharp. Thank you.